Perhaps its most famous commission, the one to Beethoven to compose his Ninth Symphony. Well, this week's programmes were produced by Chris Barstow, and today is the programme's 70th birthday. So why not visit the Radio 3 website if you have a suggestion as to a composer who has yet to be featured in the programme after all these years. The search is on, and we're going to feature the chosen composer in a run of the programme at Christmas. There's surely got to be one. Well, a very good evening to you. This is Ian Skelly, here to guide you through our evening on Radio 3 tonight. Rachmaninoff and Tchaikovsky in the spotlight in just a moment at the BBC Proms. The composer whose piece enjoys its world premiere in just a couple of minutes, Naresh Sohal, is in conversation at 10:45 tonight in a special Proms portrait. And then we'll be harking back to last weekend and the music from the WOMAD Festival in World on Three. That's at 10:45. So let's get the show on the road. It's 7:30. Time to cross live to the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's prom. Let's join Clemency Burton Hill.
A very good evening and a very warm welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, where this evening the Royal Scottish National Orchestra is joined by its new Canadian music director, Peter Ungen. He was educated in England and studied just over the road here at the Royal College of Music. He's making his proms debut tonight in a programme that's predominantly Russian, as the RSNO kick off a proms Tchaikovsky symphony cycle with the Fifth, a work once described by one contemporary critic as exhibiting all the untamed fury of the Cossack. Also on the programme, one of the greatest of all Russian piano concertos, a work often considered to be the very pinnacle of pianistic virtuosity, Rachmaninoff's Third. We'll hear from Nikolai Lugansky, a pianist who's widely acclaimed for his superb interpretations of Rachmaninoff and his ability to hit just the right balance between the passion and the poetry. But before all that, a new commission called The Cosmic Dance from Indian composer Naresh Sohal, whose last BBC Proms commission was the vast choral and symphonic extravaganza Wanderer. That was back in 1982. Sahal's musical influences include Sanskrit philosophy, mathematics, and cosmology. But for this work, he turns to a subject of even greater immensity.
I have taken the piece fundamentally from the Big Bang. I studied science as an undergraduate, and I have always been interested in what it has to say. Of course, it's a theory, and it proposes how the Big Bang happened. It doesn't say how it happened. It says it happened. And after that, we have the flux, and then the formation of, from the debris, the galaxies going away, from where we have deduced that that's how it has come into being. The first section is a section which is not defined by the Big Bang theory, but there are lines in the Rig Veda from 3,500 years BC, says Nasadasi no Sadasi Danim, which means that in the beginning was the non-being, which remains forever. And this becomes the edifix in my piece. It recurs, and the piece ends with that.
Naresh Sohal talking to me earlier. We also talked about those connections that he draws in his music between Eastern philosophy and Western science, and I wondered whether he views his music as a kind of bridge. He told me he believes a composer should only be responsible for themselves, and nobody else, no nation, no state, no earth, no anything. I'm only responsible for what is within me and what I'm allowed to express. That's what I do. And you can hear the applause here in the Royal Albert Hall for the leader of the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, Maya Iwabuchi. And here comes Peter Ungen to conduct his new band, the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, in the world premiere, a BBC commission, Naresh Sohal's The Cosmic Dance.
Thank you. Thank you.
the world premiere of Naresh Sahal's The Cosmic Dance, the fifth of this summer's BBC commissions here at the Proms, performed by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra and new music director Peter Ungen. Leading the RSNO tonight, Maya Ibabuchi. Well, the composer Naresh Sahal is making his way down to the Royal Albert Hall stage now. He describes himself as a composer who is philosophical by bent, using music as his language. When I asked him earlier why he had decided to write about the creation of the universe, he told me, in my life, that is the only question. Well, growing up in post-independence India, Naresh Sahal's father very much wanted him to be a scientist. He studied physics and maths at university, but soon realised that his destiny was to become a composer. He actually decided he wanted to write music for Bollywood films, first of all. And some of that spirit makes its way into tonight's piece, The Cosmic Dance. Conductor Peter Ungen described it to me earlier as quite an epic score, really visual. The way to listen to it, he said, is to conjure images in one's mind. He also said what a thrill it was to be presenting something that nobody has ever heard before, and made the point that orchestras have a responsibility not just to the composer, but also to the audience. He said it's vital as performers that we dedicate ourselves to great performances of new music. Here he is now making his way back to the front of the Royal Albert Hall stage with composer Naresh Sahal, who told me earlier how wonderful it is to be back at the Proms. He was last here in 1982, and he said, in older age, I realised the enormity of it, which is that it's one of the biggest commissions a composer can possibly have. It's an absolute pleasure for me. I'm in my element, and I just hope the audience shares my view of it. Certainly, he's getting a very, very warm reaction here tonight at the Royal Albert Hall. He said what a tremendous privilege it was and an honour to be here at the Proms. Well now, in a discussion inspired by The Cosmic Dance, which we've just heard performed by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, Janice Forsyth is joined by a leading Scottish writer and actor to explore some of the best Scottish writing about the cosmos.
One of the great joys of living in Scotland is our stunning evening and night skies. As well as beautiful cloud formations and sunsets, we have some of the darkest skies in Europe. And I'm told that because of the regular rainfall, the atmosphere is particularly clear. So that despite the light pollution in a big city like Glasgow, where I am now, on a good night, you can actually see the Milky Way above the high rises and the tenement chimney pots. It's a phenomenon which has swelled the hearts, stiffened the necks and stimulated the creativity of Scottish artists and writers through the centuries. So today I'll be exploring great Scottish writing about the cosmos, the sky, the infinite space beyond ourselves and the earth. The composer Naresh Sahal's experience as a little boy in Punjab, looking up and gazing at the stars and the night sky, triggered his lifelong interest in the vastness of the universe and informed the cosmic dance, which we just heard performed by the RSNO. Sahal lived in Scotland for 10 years, and I wonder whether he spent much time looking skywards while he was here. I'm sure he would have done. Most of us don't grow up to be composers or astrophysicists, but we can all relate to that early sense of wonder. And unless there's something up with our wiring, that feeling of slack-jawed awe is one which does not diminish as we get older. Quite the opposite, in fact. Well, with me is the brilliant novelist and comedian A.L. Kennedy, whose awards include the Costa Book of the Year for her novel Day, as well as the Somerset Maugham Award, the Scottish Book of the Year, and many more. I bet she'd swap them all for a hurl around some far-flung galaxies in the TARDIS with Doctor. You would, wouldn't you, Alison?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I think it's fair to say that your work blends realism and the fantastical and has approached the edge of sci-fi in a way that reveals your curiosity about the universe. And today, the good news is you are going to select some of your favourite pieces of Scottish writing on this subject. And I have another piece of good news. With us is another multi-talented Scot, actress Maureen Beattie, whose career has encompassed everything from Shakespeare and Greek tragedy to restoration comedy, radio, drama. I'm so delighted she's here with us today. Welcome, Maureen.
Hello there.
Lovely to have you here.
And it's great to be here.
Now, I have to confess, I am old enough to remember that first moon landing.
Absolutely.
The sheer excitement of it. I never wanted to be a ballet dancer. I wanted to be an astronaut, absolutely determined. For some reason, that didn't work out. I think just slightly too short. I had the physics. But that excitement that I experienced as a child has been reignited in recent months with the passing overhead of the International Space Station, the ISS, what they call clear passes on clear nights. And I'm going to fess up now. I've been out in my garden at 1 a.m, wrapped in a duvet, jumping up and down with delight, watching it and assorted satellites passing overhead and waving. And then I've also seen, as I'm sure many people, perhaps you too and our listeners, absolutely entranced by the extraordinary, the detailed photographs, particularly of Scotland, taken from space by, of course, the former commander of the space station, Chris Hadfield. Alison, so much to talk about, but just thinking of the Scottish perspective, we do have these wonderful long nights in winter, short nights in summer, further north, the Northern Lights. Do you remember back in your childhood, as a child in Dundee, particularly looking at the sky?
I do remember, and I know technically it should have been possible to see the Northern Lights, but I never have. I do remember looking up and just suddenly having that definite feeling that there was nothing above. And I got the feeling that if I'd realised there was no roof, that gravity would somehow then switch off. And I always had that feeling that I would just float up, which sometimes was exhilarating, sometimes it was worrying. But cross between the two.
I actually was lucky enough, my father, Johnny Beattie, the comedian, he was up doing a short season in Aberdeen in the autumn of one year when I was about 14, and I saw the Aurora Borealis, the heavenly dancers, as they call them up there, which was just one of the most extraordinary memories of my life. I carry it with me to my grave, this huge curtain of rainbow colours, like a giant kind of, you know, the old cinema curtains that used to swish across these huge screens at the end and beginning of a film in the great big audience, am I allowed to say that? And the other cinema chains. It was like that, but it was so extraordinary and it went on for hours. It was amazing. And I know how lucky I am.
Well, I know also you spend a lot of time in London, Maureen, but acting and so on, but I know you have a place in Butte. A wonderful island in the Scottish Riviera, for those who have not been there, the Clyde Coast. Great skies there too. Have you had a wee gander?
Oh, well, I mean, it is that amazing thing, as you say, with the clarity of, you know, the lack of pollution. You look up and you see. And of course, that famous thing is, as you look up to the sky, you see more and more and more and more. And you just feel that if you lay there for long enough, the whole universe would open up to you. It's fabulous, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm going to shiver up and down my spine. Alison, do you think, how can we pursue this? Do you think there is a particularly Scottish sensibility or understanding of the cosmos?
I think it's that the sense of scale, we translate it into otherness, and we always maybe have a little bit more doom than some other countries. I mean, one of the beautiful things was when they had those photographs, was it through the rings of Saturn?
Oh, yes.
And you saw that tiny, just heartbreaking blue, almost unseeable dot, that beautiful glow of blue, and that was all of us. Nothing but all of us. It was remarkable. I think we go for that. And if you go somewhere like Orkney, where, again, enormous skies and very strange slanting northern light, you know, of course you're going to have stone circles and stuff because you just want to kind of talk back to it. But it's that sense of that huge, which, again, I sort of felt when I looked up, that enormousness and otherness and a sort of disinterest. And I think the kind of, you know, the Scottish way, the Celtic mysticism thing, the legends and myths, you know, it's a way of somehow understanding otherness. And now we kind of have science, which is in a different way ununderstandable and beautiful. And the edge of physics is so beautiful and bizarre, or the idea of an entire planet being eaten by a black hole. I mean, that's kind of, it may well be true, but it's sort of mythically horrible.
Yeah, but thinking back to hundreds or thousands and thousands of years ago, this whole idea of look up there and think of a deity or deities. Maureen, you did make that connection.
Well, I did. I had an extraordinary experience once when I was doing a fabulous adaptation translation that Liz Lockhead did of Euripides' Medea in a huge field of old bits of Greek statuary, and we played it under a cloudless sky with a full moon and the stars out. And at one point in the play, Medea looks up and talks to the gods because she's half god, half human. And I absolutely got this extraordinary, I mean, I'm getting shivers just remembering it, feeling that there was a complete connection, like an umbilical, a huge umbilical cord going from me up into the universe. And that I was sort of simultaneously tiny and wee and insignificant, but an absolutely integral part, like every other atom in the universe is. It was absolutely fabulous, you know, and it was all I could do to kind of bring myself back and remember that I was supposed to be entertaining these people. But, you know, I almost like, what, like you talked about that thing of like feeling that you're almost floating. It was almost like that, sort of keeping my feet on the ground, you know. Fabulous.
Well, I'm sure people listening will feel that shiver as well. It's something we've all experienced. And it's this feeling, tapping into something both childlike and primal. And Alison, you've in fact chosen, you're a very modest person, but you have chosen an extract from one of your own novels, So I Am Glad, from back in 1995. Oh. But that taps into somebody else from way back, from hundreds of years ago, who was fascinated by all of this too.
Yeah, well, one of the first ideas for a novel that I had was to bring Cyrano de Bergerac, who was a real person. He's in a play and people are maybe familiar with the movies, but he was a proper writer and he wrote the first two science fiction novels ever, arguably.
Gosh.
Way, way back, sort of turn of the 17th century. And it wasn't the first novel I wrote because it scared the bejesus out of me. So I wrote another novel in which a woman got on a train and then got off, and that was your plot. And you had to be satisfied with the sense of completion that the railway station at the end gave you. But I brought him back from the dead for a sort of extra year because he died very young and made his atoms come together in Glasgow so he was able to speak English. So he became technically a bit Scottish.
And you said, you talked there about science fiction. He was imagining time and space travel, wasn't he? And indeed stories of travelling to the moon.
Absolutely. He had a variety of ways of transporting himself to the moon. There was one about a voyage to the moon and one about a voyage to the sun. And he had sort of crazy but kind of scientific and beautiful ways of, you know, like he would stand on an iron plate and he would throw a magnet in the air and catch it as he was attracted towards the magnet and throw it again was one plan. But then another plan was because he was a soldier and he knew about explosives and as far as they did, was basically to build a rocket and blow himself up. And there's an amazing description which, you know, for the time is ridiculous, of basically passing from one gravitational field to another at the point where you stop falling up and you start falling down. And he describes that moment hundreds of years before any human being experienced that moment.
So basically, Maureen, no challenge.
No.
Basically playing Cyrano de Bergerac reconstructed as a Glaswegian in a Neil Kennedy novel.
No problem. The moon was darkening. I stood and watched a shadow slip over it, as easily and quietly as if it had been my hand. Oh, and it was an impressive natural phenomenon, certainly. But I felt above all that to cast such a shadow, there must be something terribly huge and silent behind me. My logic tells me the huge something must be my own planet. I understand this. But I feel now an idea of the size of that planet. I am balanced on an enormous surface, but it does have a limit. It is only a surface. While I watch, I can see the evidence of its shape and movement darken the moon hole, then allow it to light again. Intellectually, I was happy to accept the principles of eclipse, but to know them in my heart from experience was something I found more mystical than scientific and more frightening than comfortable. I do not think any one man should feel the reality of his globe quite so personally. This is how I felt then and how I feel now. I don't want to fall.
Alison, I think you've witnessed a lunar eclipse.
Yeah, I was out walking my dog. Obviously in Dundee growing up, had a big Irish setter, they need a lot of exercise. And Dundee, it's dark most of the year for most of the time. So you're walking your dog in the dark a lot. So you got to see the sky a great deal. And I wasn't expecting an eclipse. I wasn't looking for it. And that's very freaky to look up and think, wow, you know, I know what's happening, but Huh, wow. But you definitely have that, whoa, it's behind you kind of feeling.
Yeah.
Alison, your next choice is a poem by the late, great Scottish poet Norman Macaigh. He was born, he was brought up in Edinburgh, but really infused with a Highland sensibility and a love of nature and landscape that came from his mother. She was from the island of Harris, Scottish Hebrides. I think there's something primal about this poem. Could you introduce it for us and tell us why you chose this one?
Oh, Norman Macaigh was just a beautiful man, in every sense, a beautiful man. I only knew him at the very beginning of my career when he was huge, literally, and genuinely towering over me. He was very good to be around. He looked slightly the way I would hope God would look.
Great cheekbones.
Yeah, and the hair swept back and everything. And he was introduced to me by my least favourite. She was the supply English teacher that you got if your English teacher was sick. And she had this thing about Norman Macaigh, which is how I hear his voice, his name. But she introduced me to the idea of people giving readings. And I think the first reading that I saw was Norman Macaigh being infinitely more wonderful than he was when she was reading him. But he's John Clare, but of a slightly different time. This beautiful observer. And with such an intelligence.
Was this the obvious choice then, given our theme, it's stars and planets?
Yeah, absolutely.
Trees are cages for them. Water holds its breath to balance them without smudging on its delicate meniscus. Children watch them playing in their heavenly playground. Men use them to lug ships across oceans, through firths. They seem so twinkle still, but they never cease inventing new spaces and huge explosions and migrating in mathematical tribes over the steppes of space at their outrageous ease. It's hard to think that the Earth is one. This poor, sad bearer of wars and disasters, Rolls-Roycing round the sun with its load of gangsters, attended only by the loveless moon.
Lovely. Maureen Beattie reading Norman Macaigh's Stars and Planets. I want to hear you saying it the way your supply teacher said it again. Go on, Alison.
Norman Macaigh.
Thank you for that. But that is a kind of nature writing, isn't it? You compared him to John Clare as a nature writing. Here we're getting into detail, the practical. Men use them to lug ships across oceans. It's an interesting, unique perspective on something massive and awe-inspiring.
It's just a beautiful journey if you think of the density of that. I mean, the first bit is, you know, real Norman looking at something and really, really seeing it, which is what you hope to get from a poet, that they see more than you possibly could, and then they condense it into these tiny little jewels. And then the middle verse is just... It's basically digested this absolute enormity of science, you know, inventing new spaces and huge... But it kind of summarises the way the galaxy works poetically with that little, you know, the outrageous ease, just that sense of the fact that there... It's not just size, it's the fact that it isn't interested. It's completely disinterested. It is happening without you. And then you go on to let's sum up the entire world. And, you know, he had his sort of dark, edgy bit. And I mean, Rolls-Roycing it round the sun. Mm. For God's sake, the man's a genius.
Why is the moon always loveless, we ask ourselves?
Well, you know, it hasn't got much atmosphere. Sorry.
Now, we certainly couldn't approach this subject without discussing Edwin Morgan, the great Scottish poet, translator, academic, Scotland's first Macker, poet laureate, very much a citizen of Glasgow, but anything but parochial, an internationalist, and a 20th century man fascinated by space and the technological advancements that he was witnessing. Alison, we're lucky enough in Scotland to be taught Edwin Morgan at school. Was that your first introduction to his poetry?
I was not taught Edwin Morgan at school. My school, unless we had the Norman Macaigh women, we weren't taught Scottish things in case we were infected with Scottishness, which wasn't quite as good as Englishness, and we're being prepared for greatness. But, you know, these guys were on the touring circuit, and I went to see him, and I mean, extraordinary reader. And from that moment on, apart from him being, just incredibly, passionately, joyfully interested in absolutely everything. And this dynamic reading style, like almost crazy reading style. He was just a lesson in how your mind will guarantee that you either stay young forever or you don't. He was just the youngest person I'd ever seen. Mm. And I was a very middle-aged child and getting older and stodgier and clankier by the hour. And he was kind of scary in a way.
I was lucky enough to have him as an English lecturer back in the day.
Oh, my goodness.
That was something. I used to feel sorry for him because there were hundreds of people in the English literature lecture halls, but he held us. He was fantastic.
Yeah.
And here, this is, it's called The First Men in Mercury, so it's about people leaving and arriving in Mercury.
And funny, curiously Scottish alternative language, I think.
I agree completely. When I was looking at it and working through it, I realised that, in fact, what at first appearances would seem to be a whole lot of strange syllables together that don't mean anything. But you do realise that, you know, the same sounds start to appear and they walk across the bridge from one language to another. And I've written little translations for myself, you know, for what the men are saying.
Can you give us a little example?
Well, for instance, there's one where the men from Earth say, "We come in peace." And I've written for the response to that is, "Aye, that'll be shining bright." And there's another one when they say, "We are Earthmen, take us to your leader." And I've written, "Your men, oh aye, we've been warned about you lot on the intergalactic TV service. Go away now."
Quite right.
So it's that kind of thing. And you realise that actually there is a real sense to what he's written. And and it makes it much more kind of meaty and, well, hopefully funny. "We come in peace from the third planet. Would you take us to your leader?" "Borstretter, Borstretter Hall." "This is a little plastic model of the solar system with working parts. You are here and we are there and we are now here with you. Is this clear?" "Gol, horup, bor hana hana." "Where we come from is blue and white with brown. You see, we call the brown here land. The blue is sea, and the white is clouds over land and sea. We live on the surface of the brown land. All round is sea and clouds. We are men. Men come, gloop, men. Gor ben ar menko, menhol. Men come in peace from the third planet, which we call Earth. We are Earthmen. Take us, Earthmen, to your leader." "Thmen, thmen, bor hotsop, your leader tan hana, horabos your leader." "I am the your leader. You see my hands? We carry no banner. We come in peace. The spaceways are all Stretterhorn. Glon peace, men, all horabana tanko, tan come strossop, glop your leader. Atoms are peace call in our haraban. Men bat warabos from tan hana hana. You men, we know, bor hosoptant, bor, we know, your leader. Go strog backs better, quick. We can tantabor tantinko backs better now. Bang happer now, yes, third planet, back. Your leader will go back, blue, white, brown, now, Hannah, there is no more talk. Go hand fast, happer. No, you must go back to your planet, go back in peace. Take what you have gained, but quickly. Stretterwo, goal, goal. Of course, but nothing is ever the same now, is it? You'll remember Mercury."
That was wonderful. Maureen, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Lovely.
And A.L. Kennedy, thank you very much.
That was Janice Forsyth presenting this evening's discussion about cosmic Scottish writing. She was joined by novelist A.L. Kennedy and actress Maureen Beattie. The producer was Allegra McElroy. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. Clemency Burton Hill here with you on Radio 3, home of the Proms. Now, piano concertos are a big theme across the Proms this season. And in the second part of tonight's three-part concert, we're going to hear one of the greatest of them all, Rachmaninoff's Third in D minor. First performed by the composer himself in 1909, it's often said to be one of the most technically challenging pieces in the entire repertoire, so fiendish indeed that many pianists have confessed their fear of performing it. Rachmaninoff himself declared, "I much prefer the third because my second is so uncomfortable to play." And our soloist tonight, Nikolai Lugansky, seems to agree.
"I think this is really probably the highlight of the whole history of piano concerti. And actually, this is great joy, I think, both for public and for the performer. So it's written so pianistically, so beautifully. It's really such a beautiful piece, both musical and physical feeling of beauty on piano. So here, you know, everybody is excited before the performance. I have really very personal relation to this work when I studied it from zero until I could play it without score in 3.5 days. Nobody believed me, but I was young, strong, and I was really, it was great passion to do it. Of course, I didn't play very well, but I played it from beginning till the end without the score.
In 3.5 days?
Three and a half days. I practiced, of course, a lot, and I knew music, but knew music from melodies and studied on piano, of course, a big difference. I played, of course, many times this concerto, but every time it's different, every time it's a challenge, always a lot of risk, elements of risk, but still I enjoy playing this piece always. Of course, I have some fear, but generally it's great, great joy to play this piece, and especially in such a fantastic condition for, like Royal Albert Hall, when it should be great fun.
Well, he's making his way to the stage. Coming on now to the stage of the Royal Albert Hall, Nikolai Lugansky. He'll be joining the Royal Scottish National Orchestra and their new conductor, Peter Ungern, to perform Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto in D minor. Nikolai Lugansky with an electrifying account of Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto in D minor. The Royal Scottish National Orchestra and conductor Peter Ungern here at the BBC Proms. We heard Nikolai Lugansky earlier saying that it took him just 3.5 days to learn that concerto initially, but his reading of it has just got deeper and deeper. Playing such a well-known work is like a sunrise, he says. Every day it's the same, but every day the experience is different. Lugansky was talking to me earlier about his relationship with Rachmaninoff, and he said, for me, it's about love, and I can't explain why. But in my opinion, he's the greatest Russian composer. He has huge admiration for the man as well as the musician. Promeners here in the Royal Albert Hall clamouring with their feet, hands, voices. Here come Nikolai Lugansky and Peter Ungern for another bow. Lugansky was talking earlier about how Rachmaninoff draws on his knowledge of Russian culture, and in particular Orthodox chant for that concerto, particularly the chant of the 16th and 17th centuries. He said this became his melodical language, and I asked him if he felt that resonating in his blood, and he said of course, but at the same time he would never say that a Russian has a specific claim to Rachmaninoff. In fact, he made the point that some of the greatest interpreters have been Italian, Polish, Hungarian. He said the great thing about music is you don't need to study with books, it gets directly to your heart, your mind, your soul. If you're sensitive and open, it does not matter what nationality you are. This is why music is higher than literature, higher than poetry, because we don't need any special education to enjoy it. Well, speaking of enjoyment, the Promers here at the Royal Albert Hall going absolutely wild for Nikolai Lugansky tonight, the 41-year-old Muscovite who's got such a claim for his interpretations of Rachmaninoff. He's bringing Peter Ungern back to the front of the stage for another bow. And up come the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. Rachmaninoff, of course, an extraordinarily virtuosic pianist in his own right. Interestingly, like our other Russian composer on tonight's programme, Tchaikovsky, despite all his success, Rachmaninoff had a lack of creative self-confidence. He always doubted the worth of his music, which he often revised with substantial cuts. No need to question his worth tonight. Well, if piano concerto is your thing, remember you can catch up on the iPlayer with Prom 23 from earlier this week. Paul Lewis playing Mozart's piano concerto number 25 in C. And there are all sorts of other Prom's treasures to be seen and heard online. Now, after the interval, the final piece in tonight's Prom will be Tchaikovsky's Symphony number 5. Now hugely popular, it was described negatively in one early review as exhibiting all the untamed fury of the Cossack, wetting itself for deeds of atrocity. Tchaikovsky was part of a 19th century tradition of reviving Cossack mythology, a movement being reenacted on the streets of Russia today. In tonight's 20 Minutes, Alexander Khan, cultural correspondent for the BBC's Russian service, reports on the rise of the Cossacks.
It is well known what an army raised on Russian soil for the Orthodox faith is like. There is no power stronger than faith. It is threatening and invincible like a rock, and rising amidst the stormy, ever-changing sea. From the very bottom of the sea, it rears to heaven its jagged sides of firm, impenetrable stone. It is visible from everywhere and looks the waves straight in the face as they roll past. And woe to the ship which is dashed against it. Its frame flies into splinters, everything in it is split and crushed, and the startled air re-echoes the piteous cries of the drowning.
The might and vigor of these voices, the voices of the Cossacks in contemporary Moscow, seemed to go hand in hand with the poetic beauty and reverential awe of Nikolai Gogol's text from his great Cossack novel Taras Bulba. Today, Cossacks might draw inspiration from their rich and powerful history and the colorful description of their heroic life in Russian literature, music, and painting. But there's an irony in the juxtaposition. Gogol's Cossack army was fighting for their independence and genuine Orthodox faith against the prevailing army of their neighbors and arch-enemies, Catholic Poles. The Cossack army in the streets of Moscow is fighting young women from feminist art group Pussy Riot and their exhibition in the Moscow gallery.
Here we have Cossacks from Siberia, Orenburg, Andon, and Kuban. We have hundreds of thousands of Cossacks behind us. We have millions. We're here because there is a blasphemy against our sacred Orthodox faith.
This young man, Nikolai Dyakonov, calls himself Chief of Staff of the Don Cossack Army.
And remember, next time we won't just talk.
And here we are in Kuban, an area in southern Russia, neighboring with Chechnya, where Cossacks have always lived, and where now they again picket an art show. This time a modern interpretation of classic Russian icons. In the cultured St. Petersburg, Cossacks protested the exhibition of the Chapman brothers in the Hermitage and the staging of Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita in a local theater. Arkady Kramarev, the local ataman, as the Cossacks traditionally called their military leader, is obviously embarrassed and tries to play down the importance of the protest.
There were no pickets whatsoever. All there was a letter addressed to the media that protested some exhibitions or theater productions. The letter was signed "The Cossacks of St. Petersburg." But no matter how we tried, we could not find a single Cossack who had signed the letter. So I believe this was just a provocation.
The writer and chronicler of the Cossack history, Andrei Smirnov, is much more outspoken.
It's only good that there are people in Russia who protest against Satanism, against desecration of Orthodox faith and Orthodox values. If we are being fed with this pseudo-cultural filth and devilishness, thank God that Cossacks stepped out to protect the Cossack Orthodox faith. Russian people, led and organized by the Cossacks, should kick the ass of all this pervert Western influence. Thank God the Cossacks are there.
Even within the Cossack community, there are voices of condemnation towards Rezhniy or Geysers, a contemptuous moniker given to these loud-mouthed protesters, self-appointed Cossacks fully clad in conspicuous uniform, complete with epaulettes, tall sheepskin hats, and cavalry swords. The 1917 revolution destroyed the age-old Cossack way of life, with its deeply ingrained sense of community, self-reliance, and the three cornerstones of the pre-revolutionary Russia: orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationhood. Many fled the country. The remaining were dispossessed and exiled. And by the late 1930s, the Cossacks, as a separate and distinctive social group, had virtually ceased to exist. However, the myth and the charisma, deeply entrenched in the nation's collective memory and immortalized in the arts, prevailed. No wonder that as soon as the collapse of communism lifted the ideological pressure, the Cossacks started moving towards a long-dreamt-of revival. But the social foundation for the Cossack life has not been restored, nor have they been allowed to resume their traditional military function. Sadly, much ado about trivial causes overshadows the really important questions. Who are the Cossacks today? And on which ground can they revive their identity and their community? To answer these, we need to look back a few centuries to understand who the Cossacks are historically. Yana Howlett is a lecturer in Russian history at the University of Cambridge.
Some people argue that they are actually of Tatar origin. Some people say that they are descendants of the native
population of Central Siberia. Some people have argued that they are a Circassian group, i.e. that they come from the Caucasus. But it comes to mean, certainly by the 15th century, people who are on Russia's southern and southwestern borders. It is quite clear that the early Cossack detachments were of several different ethnicities. It's only really in the 17th century that Cossacks come to be linked with descendants of Slavs, being Russian Orthodox, having served in several generations to the Russian crown. These troublesome southerners who expect to be rewarded with freedom from tax in return for military obligations in defending southern borders.
And defend borders they did. Cossack settlements, stanitsas, were stationed along the entire length of the borders of the huge Russian Empire. And the Cossacks pushed them outwards. In the late 16th century, the legendary Cossack Yamrak Timofeyevich was hired by the Ural merchants, the Stroganovs, to protect their land against the Tatars, but ended up conquering Siberia for the Tsar Ivan the Terrible. But the Cossacks were not always loyal servants of the Tsar. In the late 1600s, Stepan Razin and a century later, Emelyan Pugachev, both Cossacks, led powerful peasant revolts. Both were captured and executed, which only enhanced their wide popular appeal and heroic standing among the liberal Russian intelligentsia. Переднем стенька Разин, обнявшись, сидит с княжной. The famous Russian folk song Stenka Razin, celebrating these actions, wasn't the only artistic response. In 1834, Pushkin wrote his History of Pugachev, and a year later, in his novel The Captain's Daughter, drew a very sympathetic portrait of the still officially treacherous Cossack rebel. It was in the wake of this growing popularity and romantic mythologization of the Cossacks that Gogol wrote his novel, Taras Bulba.
An army of 120,000 Cossacks appeared on the frontier of the Ukraine. This was no small detachment sallying forth for plunder or in pursuit of the Tatars. No, the whole nation had risen, for the measure of the people's patience was over full. They had risen to avenge the disregard of their rights, the dishonourable humiliation of themselves, the insults to the faith of their fathers and their sacred customs, the outrages upon their church, the excesses of the foreign nobles, the disgraceful domination of the Jews on Christian soil, and all that had aroused and deepened the stern hatred of the Cossacks for a long time past.
In the 19th century, you have two very different visions of what the Cossacks represent.
Jana Howlett again.
One of them is they represent some kind of purity of Slav belief in ethnos and religion. So you will do anything, even sacrifice your own life, in order to safeguard your national traditions and your religious traditions. It also represents the Cossacks as being the sort of bulwark against Poland, the Ottoman Empire, so against Islam, against Judaism, really Catholicism being the strongest enemy at this stage.
Taras made raids all over Poland with his band, burned 18 towns and nearly 40 churches, and reached Krakow. Spare nothing was the order of Taras, and raising the children in the streets upon the points of their lances, they cast them also into the flames.
So he represents the attitude which kind of characterizes the first half of the 19th century, where the idea of Cossacks is being revived, where the Cossacks are being represented as traditional defenders of Russia, which is probably why in 1827 the crown prince of the Russian Empire becomes automatically the hetman of all the Cossacks. When Gogol writes about them, he represents them precisely that way.
In 1863, the Cossacks find themselves in the center of another novel, Leo Tolstoy's eponymous The Cossacks. This time, we're not in Ukraine. We're in the area which most of the contemporary Cossacks consider their main territory, borderline stanitsas in southern Russia, next to the Caucasian hillsmen, who in the time of Tolstoy, as much as now, presented the main threat to the integrity of the Russian state.
A tradition still fresh among them declares that Tsar Ivan the Terrible came to the Tiarik, sent for their elders, and gave them the land on this side of the river, exhorting them to remain friendly to Russia and promising not to enforce his rule upon them nor oblige them to change their faith. Even now, the Cossack families claim relationship with the Chechens, and the love of freedom, of leisure, of plunder, and of war still form their chief characteristics.
In Tolstoy's story, a young officer leaves the comfortable idleness of Moscow and, to the utter surprise of his comrades, volunteers to serve in the Caucasus. Amongst the Russian Orthodox Cossacks there, he finds a way of life which in its moral integrity, simplicity, and genuineness is much closer to the Chechens across the border than to the high society in the capital. Yana Howlett again.
To him, the Cossacks represent the earlier Cossack period, like the Razins and the Pugachevs, the people who organize the uprisings, who are seen as having freedoms, which they will defend against anybody. And even though they work for the Russians, they also maintain their own sense of self, which is what they are then teaching sort of the more spoilt central Russians. So, you know, they're the free, the beautiful, not too much thought and more action kind of person.
Only the harmful side of Russian influence shows itself by interference at elections, by confiscation of church bells, and by the troops who are quartered in the country or march through it. A Cossack is inclined to hate less the Jigit hillsman who maybe has killed his brother than the soldier quartered on him to defend his village but who has defiled his hut with tobacco smoke.
The Cossacks in Tolstoy's idyllic and pastoral description seem to have very little in common with the militant, bellicose spirit of Taras Bulba and his comrades. But even today, the kinship between the two branches of the Cossacks is blatantly obvious in language, in manners, in the way of life, which, I suggested to Yana Howlett, should be quite a bit of an issue in current, often strained Russo-Ukrainian relations.
Absolutely. I mean, that is why, at the moment, the whole question of what is a Cossack is highly politicized, because it also reflects what is the Ukraine versus Russia. In one vision, which is a very 19th century nationalist vision, Ukraine is the cradle of the Russian civilization. In another vision, Ukraine is a totally separate entity, defending itself both against its Western neighbors and then against Russia in the East, each of them wanting to oppress their freedoms and try to take over their culture and claim it for itself. And actually, Gogol is a very good example of precisely that. To many Ukrainians, he is a Ukrainian writer, even though he writes in Russian. Whereas to the Russians, at least, you know, to people of my generation, Gogol was represented as one of the great founders of Russian realism. Nothing to do with Ukraine at all. It's a dichotomy which continues to be problematic.
Even more problematic, given that Gogol himself was a Cossack, a descendant of the leader of the Zaporozhian Cossacks. Gogol's tales inspired one of the most renowned representations in painting of the Cossack tradition, the artist Ilya Repin's Reply of the Zaporozhian Cossacks to the Sultan Mehmed IV of the Ottoman Empire. This historic, or possibly mythical, episode concerns the writing of a letter, a mocking reply to the Sultan's demands that the Cossacks submit to Turkish rule. It took the artist more than 10 years to paint, and Tsar Alexander III bought it for 35,000 rubles, at the time the greatest sum ever paid for a Russian painting. The huge canvas occupies an entire wall in the biggest hall of the State Russian Museum in St. Petersburg and is rightly honored as one of the great masterpieces of Russian art. That's how Yana Howlett describes this historic canvas.
We have this kind of contrast between the scribe, who is an intellectual, quite clearly. It's kind of small and smiley and looking slightly bewildered, and surrounded by these Cossacks who are handsome, huge men. They're all kind of looking wild and happy as they point and laugh and just articulate rudely to show their attitude towards the possibility of vassaldom. The painting is interesting because, like so many Riepin paintings, it's both a historical narrative, or purports to be a historical narrative, and a piece of realism, but actually it's a series of body studies, very carefully posed around the table, aren't they? Especially in the foreground, this Cossack half-naked, sort of leaning over the table, with the Cossack to the right in his great hat, holding his belly. And sort of they all represent the kind of animal joy of being a Cossack, anti-intellectual, active, and able to fight with both bare hands and with arms at the drop of a hat.
So what of 19th century music? Where does Tchaikovsky fit in with this? For all his sensitivity and his homosexuality, he celebrated his Cossack side in many works, his opera Mazeppa, his Cossack dances, and in the wild, driving gestures of his symphonies.
The Tchaikovskys see themselves as descended on one side from a Ukrainian Cossack headman called Tchaika. So he may well have been kind of turning back to his roots when writing certainly some of his later work. It's a difficult one because this turning to a perceived past is not something that's specific only to Russian music of the 19th century. You find it in Czech music, French music, in Wagner, I was going to say in German music. It's hard to know to what extent the kind of the search for an authentically national music, not just in the story you tell, as in Mazeppa, but also in where you get your melodic lines and so on, whether that is specifically something that Tchaikovsky is doing or whether he's working within a much broader tradition in which the sense of being national is defined as being national both in content but also in form. And the search for a national form is a really problematic thing to be doing. That is why I'm slightly hesitant about saying it's a simple thing of turning to your past.
Turning to the past is what drives a lot of the current Cossack revival. A revival which also reflects the controversial history of the Cossacks in the 20th century, when Soviet propaganda cynically used their tradition and imagery. Quiet Flows the Don, a powerful novel about Cossacks in the Civil War, won Soviet writer Mikhail Sholokhov the Nobel Prize in Literature, even though his authorship of the book is still being contested. The 1949 film, Cossacks of Kuban, made at a time of post-war famine and starvation, depicted prosperous and happy Cossack life in the style of a Hollywood musical. It has since become a symbol of unashamedly Orwellian Stalinist propaganda. I leave the last word to Boris Almazov, prominent writer and historian. He's proud of his Cossack ancestry, bitterly wary of the prospects of Cossack revival, and vehemently critical of the current Cossack exploitation.
It's become a kind of a national cowboys and Indians game. But what are the Indians supposed to make of it? The Cossacks are howling with pain. The Don, Kuban, and other indigenous Cossack territories are bursting with problems. The Caucasus is flooded with the avalanche from the mountains that threatens to drown the Cossacks in their land. In the Don, they found copper and nickel deposits that, if mined, threaten to pollute the most fertile soil of the region. The other problem is the amateurish revival. It turns out to be quite gainful to claim Cossack ancestry. You are a nobody, a bum, but sew a braid onto your underpants and you're a Cossack. Buy yourself an aluminium cross and you're a general. The state, I have a feeling, does not have a clue what to do with all this. And another reason why I'm appalled with this tacky and phony revival is that what is popularized is only the lower village culture. And the Cossacks were different. Gogol and Repin were Cossacks. The great philosopher Alexei Losev was a Cossack. The founder of Russian cinema Ilya Khanjonkov was a Cossack. These and many other Cossacks were a significant part of Russian culture. Contemporary Cossack culture is first and foremost in preserving the gems of the original culture that we have inherited from our ancestors. There are Cossack polyphonic choirs, which is a great vocal tradition. Being a Cossack means feeling this pain inside rather than flashing it out. It's a grief within you, and it is repulsion with what you see around. I am a Cossack. and I have this pain.
Words of Boris Almazov there. The Rise of the Cossacks was presented by Alexander Khan and produced by Melvin Rickaby. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and thanks for being with us here on BBC Radio 3, the home of the proms. I'm Clemency Burton-Hill. To close tonight's prom from the Royal Scottish National Orchestra with their new music director Peter Ungern, we're going to hear Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony as part of a complete Tchaikovsky symphony cycle taking place at this year's proms. In his notebook, the composer indicated the recurring opening motto represented complete resignation before fate, a theme he also visited in operas such as Eugene Onegin and The Queen of Spades. Well, Peter Ungern is making his proms debut tonight. His rather idiosyncratic route to the conductor's podium includes almost playing for Chelsea FC, at least in his dreams, and very definitely leading the Tokyo Quartet for no less than 14 years. Earlier, I asked him how his prominent chamber career had informed his approach today.
I mean, obviously, there are huge differences between the act of conducting and the act of playing first violin in the quartet, but the mental approach to the music making and the way you listen and the way you feel about the music, there is a lot of influence from doing all those Beethoven and Bartok cycles and so on.
Audiences might be surprised, though, that you would approach a huge epic work like Tchaikovsky's Fifth from a chamber perspective.
It's wildly dramatic in many respects, but it's also beautifully intimate and introspective in many places and full of the kind of agony that seems to be almost unique to the Russian soul. That's kind of agony of darkness that we have that also in the Rachmaninoff piano concerto tonight. Sometimes it just tears through you, the anguish that these composers can express.
This is your first full season with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. How's it going so far?
Wonderful. There's a wonderful group of people, lovely musicians, eager to work. It's very, very engaged music making. They play everything, you know, the way I love it, which is like chamber music. I mean, they listen to each other and they relate each of their lines one to the other. So I'm enjoying it tremendously.
Well, he is about to make his way back to the Royal Albert Hall stage. He certainly seems to have been enjoying himself tonight. Here he is, Peter Ungern, to conduct the Royal Scottish National Orchestra in Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony in E minor.
Thank you. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony in E minor, part of a complete Tchaikovsky symphony cycle at the Proms this season, performed by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra and music director Peter Ungian, who's just coming to the end of his first season with the orchestra and conducting Tchaikovsky without a score tonight at his Proms debut. Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony, Peter Ungian says, "I love its dramatic sweep and sincerity. It's a study of the conflicts of human experience, dread, fear, and a longing for beauty and triumph. Extraordinarily conceived," he says, "as a work." Well, it's an absolutely triumphant introduction to the Proms for him and a spirited return for his new orchestra, the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. That's the principal horn player, David McClenahan, getting a rousing cheer here. Which brings tonight's Proms to a close. Thanks for joining me, Clemency Burton Hill. I'll be back with the Proms Saturday matinee from Cadogan Hall tomorrow afternoon, when we have music by Britten, Tippett, Lennox Berkeley and Gustav Holst. Sean Edwards conducts mezzo Sarah Connolly and the Britten Sinfonia. We're live here on Radio 3, the home of the Proms, from 3 p.m. Meanwhile, it's back over to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Clemency, thank you very much indeed. Clemency Burton Hill with tonight's Prom live at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's a second chance to hear that Prom on Sunday afternoon here on Radio 3, when we have the next in our series of Proms repeat programmes at 2 o'clock. Tomorrow there's lots at the Proms. There's a second chance to hear the pianist Imogen Cooper, the guitarist Christopher Denoth and singers Ruby Hughes and James Gilchrist when they teamed up at the BBC Proms Chamber Music Series at Cadogan Hall last Monday. The concert was broadcast live here on Radio 3. It was a programme of songs by Benjamin Britten, and you can hear it at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And as Clemency said, more Britten after that, when we're live at Cadogan Hall with music by him and his peers. That's at 3. And we're back at the Royal Albert Hall at 7:30 tomorrow evening to hear the violinist Vadim Repin playing James McMillan's Violin Concerto. He was the man who premiered the piece back in 2010. Also on the bill tomorrow, Johann Strauss and Beethoven, his Overture Coriolan, and to end, the Fifth Symphony, all played by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra under their chief conductor, Donald Runicles. We'll be there for that concert live here on the home of the BBC Proms, Radio 3, at 7:30 tomorrow night.
BBC Radio 3 at Proms Plus. Free events across the 2013 Proms season, capturing the musical, literary and artistic background to some of the featured music and themes. Go to the Radio 3 website or the BBC iPlayer radio app to hear some of the Proms Plus events so far, including author John le Carré celebrating 50 years since the publication of The Spy Who Came In From the Cold.
We all of us instinctively incline towards the conspiratorial moment and, quite simply, the patriotic moment.
BBC Proms Plus. Go online to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Well, back to tonight, we'll be reflecting on another festival that lit up the night last weekend in Wiltshire, the WOMAD Festival of World Music. World on 3 brings you highlights of the festival at 9:45 tonight. But let's stay with the BBC Proms a while longer and reflect on the first piece that you might have heard in tonight's concert and on much more besides. It's time for a Proms composer portrait, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music and presented by Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to the first Proms composer portrait of the season. I'm delighted to be joined on stage by Naresh Sohal, composer of the new piece in this evening's Prom, The Cosmic Dance. And we're going to be finding out more about Naresh Sohal's music with the help of young musicians from the Royal College of Music. We'll be meeting them in a few minutes' time. Now, Naresh, a bit of background, first of all, because you were born and brought up in the Punjab in pre-independence India. So I'm guessing that Western classical music wasn't part of your upbringing.
No, not at all. Western music is not part of the tradition in northern India at all. If anywhere there is Western music in India, it is Calcutta, Mumbai, and a little bit of Chennai, or Madras, as it used to be called. There were amateur orchestras here and there. I think in Mumbai there was Zubin Mehta's father who had, Meli Mehta, who had an orchestra. But I was in the backwoods of Punjab where Western music had never been around.
But I believe you did hear rock and roll and you played a Western musical instrument.
Oh, that I could hear from radio.
Yeah.
Rock and roll and also Indian movie music, which is a thriving industry. And
so Bollywood was a big thing at home, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
And you played the harmonica?
I played the harmonica, and that's how I learned music. I played it just because after my matriculation I had spare time and my friends were playing one or two harmonicas, so I picked up the harmonica. I could play it. I had a chromatic harmonica. I could play reasonably well in those days. And as there were festivals all around in college days, youth festivals and all that, I used to participate in those and play the harmonica. And one day I wanted to learn classical Indian music. So I asked the teacher who used to be appended to us, who played the violin, and I asked that I would like to learn Indian music. And he was very derisory about that. And I didn't like it, and I told him that he was responsible for the slavery of India for the last 1,000 years because he was not prepared to impart education to others than his own family.
But at this time, you already knew that you wanted to find some place for yourself in music, and but you hadn't yet discovered Western classical music at all.
Not at all. It is then that I taught myself notation with the help of a harmonica and primers. And then I taught myself harmony, counterpoint. I was a physics and mathematics student, so harmony seemed a little bit manageable with physics. And then I discovered that there was a military band nearby. And I used to go there and write marches and waltzes for them, and they would kindly play it back to me. So I learned by trading, a practice of trade. And as you know, in a military band, no instrument plays in a straight key at all. Everybody's B flat or E flat or some flat, you know. So I had to learn transpositions and everything.
It's a very good discipline, isn't it?
It's a very good discipline.
So when did the classical music hit you? Because you were studying, as you said, mathematics and physics at university. What happened? What did you hear?
What happened was that I and a friend of mine who played the guitar with me, he suggested to me, why don't we go to Mumbai, Bollywood, as you were calling it, and that we should become music directors there. It is during that Mumbai time that I actually, on an August day, had heard Eroica Symphony. That was the first time I'd actually heard a piece of classical Western music. So I listened to the second movement of it, and I said, oh, I could play that on harmonica. That seems manageable. And so this sort of brought me, and when I came home,